high 90s. Air drag was low. At normal temperature, a ball that would hit the bottom of the fence on a cool day, on a hot day, would clear the fence by 20 feet. And so we were able to come up and establish, he did all the work, trajectories and all that, and it turned out to be a very outstanding thing. Miles per hour, how, you know, the trajectory, 45 degrees, the ultimate. It was a lot of fun. People should be, you know, I marvel at the aerodynamics of an elephant. The thing that really queered me with the wind tunnel tests, I hate to say this, but I got people to say they don't want to come down and talk until I say something about the elephant and the wind tunnel. Yeah. Well, anyway, I got the first authorization to do the Mexico, another car called the Taj Mahal, and a standard 55 Ford in the wind tunnel. And on the standard 55 Ford, we would put tail fins on it, 1 square foot apiece, so we could evaluate what happens when we get into crosswind conditions, blah, blah, blah. Okay. As I went to pick up the models, one of my modelers invited me in for coffee and had breakfast before we went down to the University of Detroit wind tunnel. And I admired an elephant sitting about this high that the kids have been on. It was a black plaster elephant, all scratched. You could see the white coming through. It's a beautiful thing with its ears extended. When they charge, they have to burn a lot of energy, and their radiators are their ears, and they flatten to the most possible area. So I said, hey, can I borrow this? Take it away. We're tired of looking at it. So we haul the thing, weighed about 200 pounds, and we go down to the wind tunnel, and we're setting up to put the cars in the wind tunnel. We're unpacking our wind tunnel models and all that. So I figured, well, now's the time. Wind tunnel time was cheap in those days. It was only $200 an hour, and you could lose 2-3 hours just on making modifications on some models. And I figured, boy, this is going to be great. I'm going to run 4 tests on this elephant because it correlated in size sort of to what our 3/8 size models were. It would sort of be a baby elephant of about 5,000 pounds instead of 8,000 pounds, but I could learn a lot from that. So I've got the elephant placed. We had to glue some pads under its feet, so we could attach it to the floor of the wind tunnel. And then we'd blow a blast of air 80, 90 miles an hour and take our drag readings and all that. When who walks in but Earl McPherson, the chief engineer, to see what the devil I'm thinking of doing. And Val Talberg, who was his vice president, he was the deputy chief, I guess, and he was formerly head of Ford of Germany. And they walk in, and there's the elephant. So, Earl McPherson looks at me, and he says, what are you doing with the elephant in the wind tunnel? I says, well, I'm curious. Elephants impress me. They're capable of moving 8,000 pounds at speeds as high as 35 miles an hour. I'm trying to determine the horsepower necessary to go that fast. And so what are you going to do with it? I said, well, I'm going to make 4 tests. I'm going to take a test of the elephant charging forward. And then I'm going to take another test of the elephant going in the opposite direction with the back hitting the back end and going, because I think I'm going to get better aerodynamics with blunt shape in front and the taper this way. And then I'm going to saw the ears off. And he says, saw the ears off, and he says, for what? I says, for aerodynamic braking. I expect to get data. on where to put our aerodynamic brakes, in the front or in the rear, and what happens, you know. And he looks at me and he says, of what interest to the Ford Motor Car Company is the aerodynamics of an elephant of interest except to another elephant? He turns around and walks out. And as he walks out, he says, what are those skis doing there? This is in the summer. What he didn't know is I had Alan Bushnell, who had jumped 320 or 400 feet at Iron Mountain. And he was one of our designers. And I figured, I'm going to put you in the wind tunnel, bring your skis, and we'll run some drag just like this and see what we can do. That's what they're doing now. It's crazy.
You had some milestones at Ford in terms of advanced design, the Gyron and others. Can you give us a little bit about the experiences with them?
All right, from New Mexico, the Taj Mahal was highly creative. It could have been the new Mercury. And let's see, I had the Volante Triathodyne, which was the first air cushion vehicle in the world. I had the X1000, where I had dual tires in the front and rear, put together like this. That's the latest state-of-the-art in tire technology, if you look at one of these scientific magazines. Besides, it's a rain splitter. I did the Seattleite, dedicated to the Seattle World's Fair in 1962. Then the Ford Gyron. The Ford Gyron, I think, was my ultimate expression of the art. I had to do the Gyron because I heard rumblings through the grapevine that Firebird 3 was going to be the most exotic car in the world. Some said it's got four tail fins. Somebody said, no, it's got six, and it's wild. And double bubbles or something. From this meager data, I figured, well, it's possibly like the turbo catamaran that I had designed, two bubble canopies like this. And also Ford at one time came up with the thing that Bill Schmidt designed that was called the, started with a V, honey. No. Well, at any rate, Futura, built by Gio. Yeah. And getting back to the Gyron, I figured what I've got to do, I've got to design a thing so dramatic that even Firebird and GM can't even catch up to what I'm trying to do. So I thought I'd reduce everything to the simplest denominator. And I built a small model with the gyroscope and was able to prove that I could stabilize an automobile on two wheels. If I did this, I no longer had to be inhibited with looking at a box with four wheels on it and trying to change lines here and there. I've got the classic statement, one wheel in front, one in back, with beautiful ducting and fairings where I lowered the resistance of wheels and also had banking capability like this. And I would demonstrate this model. And it finally got to the point where Ford had just purchased Aeronautronics. And at Aeronautronics, there's always professional jealousy when you get consultant engineers and consulting studios and all that. At Dearborn, they used to refer to Ford Aeronautronics as Ford Aeroneurotics. And why the hell did you go there for gyroscopic information? And I hated to tell them because I talked to people at Ford and they didn't even know what I was talking about. So I wasn't exactly very popular. There was the Cobra Mongoose affiliation between styling and engineering. But I was fighting for aerodynamics. I figured this is the key to the whole thing. And I'm not going to wait for any mysterious engines to come from outer space, off-the-shelf things, and we'll shoot for ultimate aerodynamics. Well, the Gyron was a sensation. It was a very simple, delta-shaped thing. It looked like an Earth reentry vehicle coming in for a landing. And it made a very powerful statement. Now, the thing was this. This is when the era, as we say, the 50s, when 100 show cars were built, like the Thunderbolt, as we went, was one of them. but 100 of them all scattered between Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler. I think Ford, we built more than, between Gil Spear and I, we built more than General Motors did. Some were propaganda models. We'll get to that later. Especially when Tucker came out. Are we getting close?
Can you sum up the Gyron as a culmination of your thinking at this point?
Yes.
In time?
Yes, okay.
In about two or three minutes.
Okay. When I did the Gyron, I always live by the headlines, too. I did the Gyron, became very unpopular. It looked like to keep peace in the family, I should leave the company, which I did. But it led to one thing. Since I committed political suicide by designing the Ford Gyron, I figured that, it must have been 63, yeah. President Johnson wanted a 200-mile-an-hour train. So I came up with the LBJ Gyronaut. That's what I called it. Because I decided I'm going to prove that things can go fast with two wheels. So when they asked me, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to build the world's fastest motorcycle. I knew nothing about motorcycles. I took a fast trip to the Bonneville Salt Flats. I saw motorcycles in action, and they had problems at 160 miles an hour. So I said, I'm going to design the world's fastest motorcycle, and I'm going to do it with less horsepower than anybody in the world. And with 90 horsepower, I predicted that we would be the first press conference to go 250 miles an hour. I was a little embarrassed. We only did 247.6, but I did it with 90 horsepower, which translated to moving one person through the air at 100 miles an hour and only using 4 horsepower for aerodynamic drag and tire rolling resistance of 90 psi. This meant I could design a train and I could move 200 passengers through the air and be gyro-stabilized, bank through a corner like an aeroplane. We proved that. And we built, this is after I left Ford. And I certainly proved, then I got involved with land speed records and all that. I'm still at it. I was a consultant to ARPON.
This is Dave Crippen, and this is June 16th, 1984, and we're speaking today in Ann Arbor with Mr. Alex Tremulous, world-famous designer and proponent of the three-wheel vehicle, among other things. I wonder, Alex, if we could, with your usual eloquence background, if we could perhaps, since you've described the Tucker experience at some length elsewhere, I wonder if we might deliver, as you most properly could, a sort of a loving epitaph to the experience at Tucker and your relationship with President Tucker.
Yes, Dave, I found that the Tucker Corporation was a very exciting period of my life. Number one, I was quite impressed with the philosophy that Preston believed in. Was a state of very revolutionary thinking and development. He was a very inspiring man, and somehow or other he surrounded himself with, when he was looking for talent, especially among metal men, the Indianapolis Speedway was the citadel he operated from. He had a tremendous respect for Harry Miller, as an example, and was closely associated with Harry Miller, retained Harry Miller, I would say, as a consultant. You can see evidence of it in our suspension units where we used front parallel arms and all that, racing technology. And, of course, he also had purchased and owned several of the Miller race cars that were strictly there for inspiration for the chassis designers. And years ago, Duesenberg claimed that the saw flats were the crucible of racing, and tremendous philosophy of technology that came from the racing eventually filtered on down to the average consumer. He was a motivating force. I don't recall even seeing any clocks in the shop. As far as hours, we never knew what an eight-hour day was. When we built the automobile, the timetable seemed to be impossible. He wanted a 60. He wanted a prototype done in 60 days. In those days, it took 90 days to make a clay model. And when we went into, he said we'll eliminate that. Program of modeling a car, we're going to go right straight from sheet metal, starting with flat sheet metal. It wasn't for the heavy talent that he had there, and when we needed some assistance, I brought in two or three people from Briggs LeBaron, especially the LeBaron Custom Body Division. We were probably one of the last of the Mohicans from all the illustrious custom body companies at that time. He was there for many, many hours. There were times at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, he would show up to see how things were going and to make sure that all was well. And sure, we made a lot of mistakes and anything in a preliminary project. When we thought we were making progress, something wouldn't quite work out, so we'd have to go back and sometimes wonder when you try and make two or three steps forward. Sometimes you backslide two or three times, and it does take longer. But somehow or other, we didn't hit that 60-day target, but it took us 100 days. And with the small crew we had, about six or seven people actively engaged in the building of that car, that was quite phenomenal, really. And when I look at some of the prototype automobiles in the history of styling that we built, it's no problem at all to spend sometimes 2 or 3 years in developing a dream car. I've heard that the General Motors LeSabre was an example. Supposedly he had so much electronics in there, I think they said it was well over a mile and a half or two of just wiring, such as necessary electronics. If raindrops came down, the top would automatically go up. And the instrumentation in some of these cars was so fantastic, I really thought you'd need a co-pilot just to read the numbers. But they made very impressive electronic displays. But these dream cars are the guinea pigs. And they telegraph, public reaction telegraphs to us what they really like and didn't like. In some of these dream cars, we used to put tape recorders just to register the O's and the ah's and the other comments, even that they were derogatory, which gave us a real good feeling of public reception. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yep.
At the time of the Tucker automobile, I had just left the Air Force, but the Air Force called me back as a design consultant some 6 weeks after I got out. I was to go back to Wright Field, but Wright Field in those days was still operating as they were, salary-wise, with officer personnel, and officer personnel and civilian personnel. The wage scale was very, very small for the service in those days. And I had signed up with an industrial design firm, and but they had a special secret think tank that was called ARO, which was headed by General Sverdrup and Parcell. This was a super sophisticated operation that built some of the, and designed some of the world's largest dams. They also were responsible for, I would say, possibly 80% of all the wind tunnels built in the world. They were capable of designing, as an example, this is unbelievable, steel tubes for a wind tunnel. We were talking of wind tunnels that would take a full-size aeroplane in those days. That would test a full-size aeroplane at speeds of Mach 1 and Mach 2, which is absolutely unbelievable. Because with wind tunnels, the state of the art really dictates that whatever object you put in the wind tunnel, especially in the test section, that that particular object should choke, let's say, just 4% of the area. And in other words, if you put a very big model in a small wind tunnel test section, you run into horrendous numbers of skin friction, wall friction, and it's very difficult to get a realistic, realistic data. At that time, I was involved with designing a new research and development center, as Wright Field was to become obsolete, and the Aero operation was to build the most advanced research R&D. It was really the AECD, Arnold Engineering Research Development Center, and we were to think way, way in advance. And I was just told, you just continue doing what you left at Wright Field, but put us in outer space. And the only formula they said was some Austrian or Hungarian had established the fact that if we could ever reach velocities of 7.5 miles per second, we could then place objects in orbit. And I was there for about 9 months, but the problem was what we needed was a research and development budget of $4 billion in order to beat the Russians to wherever we were at. At that time, unfortunately, when peace comes, we become the most lackadaisical people in the world. We suddenly become very conservative, as if nothing, we don't have to prepare for any emergency. Budgets are cut down. I saw overnight aircraft contracts terminated so fast that we nearly destroyed the entire aircraft industry companies. As an example, a telephone message would state, we've just decided to cut down our orders of, let's say, 1,000 P-80s to 10 airplanes. And here you're talking to a company that has 25,000-30,000 employees, and there's no way that they can shut the water off that fast. They need time. And our engine development programs practically ceased, and we had the General Spare had just come back and told us what the state of the art was. He said that the Russians had taken over the island of Peenemünde, and that the General Dornberger and the Werner von Braun operation, they had taken over the Nordhausen V-2 rocket plant, and when they inherited it, the production was 900 a month V-2 rockets, and that they eventually got the production up to 2,000 rockets a month, and we were at a dead standstill. So when I go down to the Pentagon, I would have to show drawings and sketches of what we were going to do, what we were planning for, and as an example, when we had spent our first $110 million on rocket research, the Russians had just got through spending their first $1 billion. When we reached our $1 billion budget, they had just got through spending $4 billion. And we were a giant at the end of the war, but we were just, we were now a sleeping giant. And we felt that if we had a, if the research budget over a period of from 1946 to 1952, we could spend $4 billion. Our target for putting a man in orbit was the year 1952. Sputnik came out in 1957. In 1957, we would have had space stations in orbit with the plans that we were thinking about. The Military Appropriations Committee would say, oh, that's wonderful, but now what can you people do for $2 billion? We figured just about half. So I'd have to go back to St. Louis. We'd cut out this laboratory. We'd vaporize this one. We'd give another one a low priority. And then I'd come back and they'd say, now this looks fine. Finally, they got to the point where they said, we we've looked at this, it's all very interesting, and the final assumption was, what can you do for $666,666.66? And I just put up my arm and said, absolutely nothing. I became so discouraged, even though the general wanted me to stay on, that I decided I think I'd better go back in the automobile industry. But it showed one thing, and it emphasizes the axiom that you just simply have to have forward thinking research and development, and not have it harassed by budgeteers. In fact, it got so bad, actually, I hate to say this, but what we really needed with these wind tunnels, I never expected we could hit these targets. If we ran all our wind tunnels at the same time, we needed 6.5 million horsepower. How we were going to get it? Well, we were going to Grand Coulee Dam as a million horsepower. We were going to build five more dams on the Colorado River. Harry Truman came in and said, no, you can't do that. All you're going to get is the TVA operation. And that's good for 750,000 horsepower. That would be nothing. I mean, we'd be taking all the horsepower away that electrifies and gives us lights and all that just to run some wind tunnel tests. So perhaps they thought we were a little too extravagant. But the thing is, today we are spending billions and billions of dollars on pure research, and that could have all been cut down because it's so difficult to make up for lost time, and especially technology. So then I decided, well, there's a chap by the name of Preston Tucker in Chicago, and I think he's trying to build a very intelligent automobile. So I'm going to go down there, and I'll make some sketches first. I'll go down there and see what if I can be of any help. I thought the car was already designed for the publicity that they had. Now, one of the designers was George Lawson, and he had come up with a very beautiful concept of an automobile. It had movable front fenders. Now, this was what Preston Tucker really wanted, and it was a very difficult thing to do. But George had made a very beautiful automobile that was very well rounded, with the doors that went into the roof, but they went in so high it showed some problems of tricky door mechanisms where you'd have to pull the door out and then open the door. It certainly didn't adapt itself to a production automobile. Everybody wanted six seats. Preston Tucker at that time didn't have the chassis design, and George Lawson had no dimensions to really work from. So his cars, his designs were very beautiful on paper, but for carrying passengers, a big automobile the size of a Cadillac, it'd be unthinkable that the rear passengers would have to be 10-year-old. So someone had to walk in and pretend this is a production car, and that's when I walked in. And when I called him up, it was really funny. He said he could only give me 15 minutes, and that he already had a designer. And when he gave me 15 minutes, I felt like saying, yeah, that's all you're going to get. And when I got up there, he had everybody there, Fred Rockelman, Lee Treese, and all that. They wanted to see this this designer called Mr. Tremulous. I walked in, showed a few sketches. They all said, wow. And it didn't take long. That 15 minutes I was supposed to have with him escalated. We went through lunch, no lunch at all. And we talked, and at 3:30 in the afternoon, he says, you've got the contract as a consultant. So then they terminated the contract with George Lawson. George Lawson was really one of the greatest designers that I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. But tremendous value as a forward-thinking dreamer. But to be realistic and put a car into practice, he had developed a quarter-size model that they photographed, and it looked like it was a full-size car. And the photography, a lot of people thought that was the automobile. And that was really triggered a lot of people who, I would give George Lawson credit with that particular design, as stimulating interest in the Tucker automobile. It made the Pick magazine, and Pick magazine apparently had a tremendous following. Publicity was there. So I don't know how much time they had spent on that design, but I think George was a consultant there for maybe a year or two, I'm not sure. Because supposedly the thinking started when the war ended in 1945, and really things didn't get going till early part of 1948, as far as building the first of the 50 cars. Uh, Of course, I only had 5 days, even with my preliminary drawings, to make changes. Tucker's reaction was, for God's sake, don't make this thing look like it was scared by an aeroplane. And I assured him it would still be an automobile. Very frankly, with the engine in the rear, I was tempted to put some tail fins there because I figured we really need tail fins, but I figured I'd be hung from the nearest tree if I came up with that, because he didn't show absolutely any interest in tail fins. Necessary for aircraft, but strictly for the birds in an automobile. And, of course, the pace was hectic. We built the Tin Goose. The Tin Goose was the master model. And looking at the Tin Goose, I sometimes think that's a little bit better than our production job, because we the thing that irritated me most was that when I went to a... I really had off vertical, I had a 50-degree windshield, and we backed it up to give you a little more header room to 45 degrees. But that's a tremendous trifle that hardly anybody can see. Oh, you mean to tell me this is it? Oh, my goodness. Well, it shows that sometimes in advanced concept, I'm amazed at the publicity that this car is getting. After all, it's 38 years old. Perhaps it's a new generation looking at it, or two generations looking at it. But, oh, there's a few things I would have changed, perhaps, now that I think of it. But, it's certainly passed the test of time, hasn't it? And that's the acid test. If they still look good after 30 years, 35 years, going on to 40, 2 years, Halley's Comet will be here. That's the one that we missed in 1910. Well, it had an aerodynamic philosophy. The cars of that day had a coefficient of drag of 0.55 to 0.65. And this car, I had built the wind tunnel model, and it was a small 1/8 size model, so I had to look for a small tunnel. And I went to the University of Chicago and met with a Dr. Retaliata, who said he could give us information on the model, but I'd have to have a very accurate 1/8 size model, which we built. By the time we were ready to confirm its aerodynamics, we were going out of business. And I do wish it had gone into the wind tunnel, because it'd be so much easier to have a confirmation. But our confirmation was we conducted rolling tests versus a Buick automobile and a Cadillac downhill coasting, and measured the distance and the maximum speed received. And in the coast down test, we were so far superior in distance travel with the engines in neutral that we were able to extrapolate coefficient of drag numbers. Now, to confirm it later on, several years later, through Victor Borgazion, who was a consultant to Kaiser Fraser, who was a close associate to Jean Andreau, who was France's leading aerodynamicist, I asked for a study on the coefficient of drag of this vehicle. Borgazion and Jean Andreau stated it was 0.28. I said, that's impossible. I'll agree that it's possible, because if you say so, it must be so, but no one on earth is going to believe such a ridiculously low number at 0.28. So I said, let's make it 0.30. That's good enough, and I'm still sticking to it. But you can see that my thinking was getting closer to my dream that the think tanks should be a happy marriage of aircraft people and automotive engineers. Much could be done. We've got to do something with the automobile. I thought it was starting to run amok. Horsepower race was on. No one knew where it would stop. In fact, one time at a sports car meeting, when Ed Cole, who was chief engineer of General Motors, I provoked a little bit of laughter when I stated that the horsepower race is now in high gear, and there's no question in my mind that General Motors is going to pick up all the marbles because they have all the tooling for the Allison engines, aircraft engines, that'll give us some 1,722 cubic engines. And they all laugh, and he got a big kick out of it.
It certainly was a good 20 years ahead of its time, wouldn't you say?
I'd say closely, yes. Let's see, 48, 58, 68. Yeah, the car still looked very viable 20 years later. When we start extending our rear ends a little bit longer, we're going to reduce the pressure drag that we get and the turbulence that we create in the rear, which is really horsepower consuming, and it's definitely a fastback, but it's a fastback, and in its vertical and horizontal plane, everything seems to be coming to a point. And the real secret of it really is the very fact that our internal drag is practically eliminated. I mean, it's very interesting when these engines are running, you put your hand behind the rear grille, air is coming out under pressure, it's being forced out. And as it's being forced out, it preserves the boundary air layer all the way to the rear end of the car. And 6% of the total drag is very, very impressive. You hate to design an automobile. When you start adding up things, you say, oh, I forgot the hole in the front. And you just ignore it. But then when you go into full-size testing, and we still don't really know, unless we have a car on a big revolving belt, because when you put an automobile, you got the air flowing around at 80 miles an hour, but the ground plane is still not moving with the car. Aircraft, it's different. You just put the model, it's a three-dimensional body, you put it in the middle, and you don't have to contend with that. And low-speed tunnels today are only being used for landing characteristics because their velocities at 110, 120 miles an hour give us very valuable data on landing characteristics. But the largest wind tunnel right now, the General Motors wind tunnel, is a pygmy compared to what we were proposing. In fact, the numbers are so horrendous that I said, no one's going to believe we can go this far. And it was a top secret thing at that time. So I just tore it up in small little pieces. I wish I had it, because if I talk today about, if I mentioned the numbers, what our tubes really were, you would just shake your head. It was an unbelievable. But you have to, in advanced thinking, set your sights real high, knowing you're going to have to compromise and get knocked down. But the only reason I got to that particular point was that in a book, They Tamed the Sky, I'm termed as one of 10 men who tamed the sky in World War II. It was my Operation Dinosaur, where I wrote an airplane, designed an airplane that sat on top of a booster like this, and we launched it into outer space. And before we even knew anything about rockets. And at that time, it was just a dream sketch. It was really the prelude to the space shuttle. That's one thing the astronauts really detested, was coming down and landing. That was the most terrifying part, landing on the ocean. And with the helicopters for 20 minutes, hovering and having water all over and trying to get them into a rubber boat. In fact, they were so terrified that later on, when they became hot shots, they'd fly in on the wire, and they were really trying to land right on the Enterprise. Forget this. But then when they were able to land and come home in an Earth reentry vehicle, now it's a piece of cake, no problem. Now it's a piece of cake, no problem at all. The Russians haven't even reached that stage. They're still bailing out at 25, 30,000 feet. And I guess they've lost a couple of people in doing that. But just like the automobile industry, the space industry is just as volatile as far as competition. I think the big secret of American technology might have been triggered by one of our biggest failures, which was the Vanguard rocket. I think we built 10 or 11 of them, and about 9 of them, I think, broke in half to takeoff and all that. But the lesson that came from that failure gave us superiority in this sense. Operation Vanguard gave us miniaturized electronics. Everything was so small and light. And the heck with Sputnik that weighed 157 pounds. We put a little 8-inch grapefruit with 4 aerials. I forget what it weighed. It's a material. It weighed nothing when it got up there anyway. But and everything that the Russians did was gargantuan. When we heard that they had 500,000-pound thrust rockets, sure, they had taken 7 V-2s, wrapped them around as if you tied them together with a rope, and then lit 7 wicks, and up it went. Not very sophisticated. Their first pictures of the backside of the moon were just globs. They were horrible. Those little vague spots. But then when we took our trip around, we got some very beautiful pictures. It's unbelievable how... I remember I used to say, what the hell's wrong with you guys? We shot a missile of the moon, and I held a quarter out there like that. And I said, the moon's got a diameter of 2,200, let's say 2,000 miles. And you fellas missed it by 4,000 miles like that. Diameter, and then here's where you went. And they said, well, Alex, look, you bear this in mind. Pretend you're on a swing. And you're swinging away, and we let a balloon out there, and you've got a gun, and you aim. You really don't know where you're at in outer space, and we still don't know where we're at in outer space. Today, we know exactly where we are in outer space. It's unbelievable. We can pinpoint landings from here to the moon in a 100-foot circle. I mean, it's that precise. So, maybe I'm dwelling too long on this facet of it. Now, the Tucker automobile in its day, to really be evaluated properly, visually, by the human eye, let's say, should always be shown with the group of cars of that vintage. In other words, there's only one car that really made a contribution or looked like it belonged in the family or in the design philosophy of the Tucker automobile, and that was possibly the Hudson. The Hudson was a step-down vehicle, and of course it had the hump and in the middle to encompass the drivetrain, but it at least showed a semblance of, with a well-rounded roof, it wasn't a fastback, but a well-rounded windshield. It showed that it had some regard for aerodynamics. It was very heavy looking, made some of the mistakes of the one of the early Packards when they first went to the full single fender. The belt line was horrible, and they said it had elephantiasis. But that was the closest thing. But the other cars looked like they were all 10, 15, maybe 20 years behind the times. The Tucker, styling-wise, made a powerful statement. It had swept-forward fenders and headlights that looked like they were boring through the air. Looking at the front end, minus grill work, but beautiful, clean sheet metal, indicated to anybody that whether they understood streamlining or didn't, that this was indeed a very slippery way for a vehicle to go through the air, and that the back end had that aircraft quality look of beautiful tapers as if it's going to a pointed tail in the back. And the fenders with scoops looked functional because they were as necessary as scoops on aircraft to tell air where to go and where not to go and dump it out to where it should go. All these little things all added up to the point where people could identify the car immediately. There was nothing nothing on the car that showed the present and the past. It was a bold execution. The center headlight, which was turned, which would turn with the wheels, was a stroke of genius as far as the public was concerned. In practice, I wanted the opposite to happen. On the future models, I wanted the two movable headlights, and they were to be at the fenders, because, and the center light would be a straightforward, high-intensity light beam, because I found that it was very difficult for the center light to really penetrate through the right side of the beam on a right turn. And what it did, though, it did intensify it, and it did show you that it gave you better visibility. But the ultimate way to have gone would have been to go under glass. When I even thought of that, let's say on the 1952 major breakthrough, that there was a lot of resistance from the government against putting headlights under streamlined optics or glass. The automobile industry for years screamed and said that, for instance, we've got to lower the standard of the standard height centerline of the headlights that are based at 28 inches off the ground. We want it knocked down to 24. It probably took us 10 years to get that through. And it's taken us years to get flush glass over these big existing cavities. We've been fighting for that for years. I remember in 1937, John Jarda wanted to see four headlights on a car. And he was impressed with the fact that in 1934-35, I showed him a design of a car as one of my samples of four headlights. They were both vertical. The top beam was the was the high light, and the bottom beam was the city light. And because it got to the point when, if you was really designing an automobile, I know in one particular car I just did this. I just took a headlamp bezel, put it up there 24 inches above the ground, took a tire, a wheel, I'm just trying to imagine full size, and another tire to the wheelbase, and then a taillight in the back, and then I take a piece of wood and do that, and say, okay, this is a fender line. So I'm stuck with a fender that goes like that, because that's what the headlight dictates it. The retractable headlights appeared on the cord because they couldn't meet. They wanted them to be flush glass, but it was impossible to meet that 28 inches. So they had to retract the lights up and get them up in the air to meet it. And all they needed was an eighth of an inch. I said, can't we cheat a little bit and put a couple suitcases in the back? No, you can't. And we ran into those problems with Tucker, at Tucker. The government came in there, and they come in with a test thing on four wheels, semblance of a bumper, and they back it up to your car like that and see where your bumper is. And you have to hit it right in the middle, 16 inches in front, 18 inches in the rear, because the cars usually would break and the rear ends would go up. We didn't want to put bumper guards, so we had to design our bumpers to take care of these little up and down deviations. Finally, there were so many states. We were illegal in 14 states with our center light. And I came up with the solution, let's just stamp, make a nice stamping with the Tucker crest, snap on. So when you go through these 14 states, you just snap this thing on and you can get through the state. I mean, you have to deal with the government sometimes as if they're children, delinquents. You can't legislate design of an automobile. I think it should be left up to the professionals. We're building smaller cars now, mini cars, and we're making boxes out of them. We're making them so short that I believe in the little excess in the front, a little excess in the back, and we write that off to crushability in an accident. If you're going to hit somebody, don't hit them with a tube. Take a rubber hose. That's a little easier. But you got to keep people alive in these automobiles. The only way to bring the death rate down is to make sure that every car is locked in your garage. And then when you start walking, you can walk at 5 to 7 feet per second. You can run into a wall and really injure yourself very badly. The minute motion is involved, the danger starts existing. You want to shut it off so we can relax for a while? After my 1952 SAE speech, for Kaiser Fraser. That may have been the turning point of my career. I was immediately approached by the Ford Motor Car Company, Elwood Engel, and Frank Hershey, George Walker. Were quite impressed with what I had to say and offered me a job at the Ford Motor Car Company. I came in as a senior stylist and worked in the Ford division for about 6 or 8 months and was transferred to the Lincoln Mercury division under Bill Schmidt And when Gil Spear, who was Mr. Advanced Styling in my opinion, expressed a desire to get involved with full-size cars, that he had spent 5 or 6 years of 3/8 modeling and wanted a different change of pace, the door was open for someone to head the advanced styling section that he had vacated. And it seemed to be quite unanimous that at times, even though I was controversial, I was very far advanced in my forward thinking, and that I should be the logical candidate. In a way, it was a tough act to follow because Gil had done such a magnificent job. But what it was happening was that there was a shortage of stylists. And do you have a cigarette? I forgot what I said, but that's all right.
You were talking about Gil Spear and the...
Oh, yes, yes. Now we had to train students, and now they wanted me to try and get for every semester 20 or 25 students, which meant I had to approach at least three big schools. I visited many of the schools all over the country. As an example, I went to Pratt Institute, New York. I figured here is the highest density area in the world. And 6% of the population, this state, on a clear day, that's what they said you could see. So I figured I should get 6% of my designers from this particular area. I interviewed, I think, 62 people, and only came back with one. I thought that was a terrible ratio. But then I analyzed the fact that when one has an automobile in New York, it's a tremendous liability. Where are you going to park the car? It's a nightmare. People prefer to use mass transit, that parking could go as high, way back in 1950, as high as $7.50 a day, and that the typical mode of transportation was either mass transit or a bus, or better yet, a taxicab. That was the only way to go from point A to point B. And youngsters growing up in such a generation have no love for an automobile. It's a liability, and consequently, when they were drawing automobiles, they even lost the scale. I'd ask them, what kind of a car do you drive? Oh, well, I don't drive a car. Very few people did. The island of Manhattan, I would say, whatever its population was, and percentage in the state, in my opinion, determines how many cars are there. If you choked up the tunnel to Manhattan, it would be catastrophic, because there's well over 1 million people there that have to be fed with trucks supplying things. A truck accident in the middle would be a disaster. Now, at the other end of the country, here's California. Beautiful weather. Maybe 2 or 3 weeks at the most of rain every year. Kind of a country where you can keep a convertible top down overnight and really enjoy the air and become an automotive enthusiast. When MG and Jaguar and all the sports cars came to this country, even though the state of California, and this still exists today, the state of California is only 10% of the country's population, so they should technically have 10% of the car population. But when you get to the specialized cars, the sports cars, the cars that people dream about, like T-Birds, 40% of our T-Bird production went to California. In other words, there's 4 people to 1 that really want, that are psychologically geared to wantmanship of a Jaguar, Mercedes, or a T-Bird. And we find that also in the Cadillac Lincoln range. So the bulk of my designers, as an example, I would hire every semester 5 people from the school, Cleveland School of Design, which had a very fine curriculum, and 10 students every semester. And since the Art Center had 3 semesters, really, I used to get 30 people a year. And they would spend their last semester, for instance, those that came from the Art Center School, which was operated by Tink Adams, the founder of the school. They would spend their semester, their final semester, with me, and I would actually give them their marks. And then we'd all get on an airplane and go back to Art Center for the graduation. And we also had students coming in from Rhode Island, Parsons School of Design. Parsons School of Design was merely a good school for dress designers. But once in a while, somebody would pop out who could draw an automobile, and you might get somebody. But the Rhode Island School was another school where we got some of our designers. Syracuse was another school. Some people suggested that I go down to New Orleans. I says, no, I'll find our cane workers down there. Steel scroll work. Geographically, I was also looking for talent in Middle America. This is what I really wanted to do. So that as far as Florida, I sort of gave up on Florida, because people are either going down there, they like it, and the hot summer comes, and they get out. So that was a little difficult. But New York was strictly absolutely a big bust. They made it when they had people like Donald Doner, who passed away, and Alexander Costello. And then they lost it. The bulk of designers are all now coming from, of course, Detroit had a wonderful school, and it still is a tremendous, it may be the best school in the country. I hate to say this because Art Center certainly wouldn't like it, but facts are facts. Some very outstanding designers now being trained right here in Detroit at the Institute of Creative Studies. It's quite a school. In fact, I initiated advanced styling at that school in 1963 after I left Ford. Now the training out in California, the students are just exuberant. They're all autoholics. Got an automobile to them is it's a symbol of life. When they came to Dearborn, they couldn't understand how come I didn't wash my car every day. I was living in Ann Arbor, and I'd go to Dearborn. I'd show up with my white T-Bird all full of dust, dirt. Didn't take them long to realize that keeping an automobile clean out here isn't like California. I mean, California, you've got nothing to do but just wax your car and admire it and love it, go to auto shows, and you have to go through a phase of being a hot rodder. You have to know what life is like on the drag strip. You better join the Sports Car Club of America, otherwise you shouldn't be allowed to even drive on the road. and you develop a very strong camaraderie. I remember when in MGs, TCs, when we'd see each other, we'd greet each other. And then along came the Jaguar 120s, and the new aristocracy came in, and we'd wave to them because they belonged. They had the same blood in their veins. They were sports cars, too. And they'd give an MG a thumbs down like this. Or they'd hold their nose. And so the class system started going up where today in Beverly Hills, you go to a car wash there, and you'll see three big Mercedes 380s in line, sprinkled with and a little interference. A Rolls Royce will appear on the scene, one out of every four or five or so. 40% of the Rolls Royces are all sold out here in this state, and you hate to park a Rolls Royce in New York, so you need a chauffeur who's constantly attending it. And the mystique of the automobile owner is something. We have to be psychiatrists and psychoanalysts. When George Romney came out with the economy type American Motors cars, they generated a certain clientele. You could usually tell an American Motors driver, he would wear a hat. He had room for the hat, for one thing. And they're all nice people. American Motors people had the highest degree of pipe smokers. Pipe smokers are very nice people. You find very few of them in jail. And then when you got on the on our turnpikes from here to New York, it'd be a common sight sometimes to see four or five Nash American Motors cars all going in formation, following each other because they had a sense of security. I'm always inquisitive by nature. I used to go and visit the parking lots in churches, and I found that even though American Motors might only be responsible for 1% of the car population, if you went to a parking lot on Sunday at a church, it looked like 5 or 6%. They're very nice people. And I even talked to head of the Jackson prison, and I asked him, could you run a survey for me? I want to find out what the percentage of Ford owners versus GM owners are, and American Motors people. And I forget what the numbers were. There were something like a little over 120 Fords versus 135 Chevys, and only one American Motors car. And I was more interested in the one American Motors guy, and I said, I'd like to talk to him. He said, well, that can't be. What do you want to ask him? I just wanted to ask one question. Was it his automobile? No, he had stolen it. And that's how he got... I talked to a banking group one time, and I thought I'd have a little fun. I'm not a banker. I don't know anything about it, but I came up with my solution or proposal on how to rob a bank, and the main thing was the getaway car. And when I said, most of the getaway cars, in your opinion, what are they? So they said, oh, they're people with Chevy, high-speed Chevy engines and all that. And I just wound up the whole thing by saying, well, the ultimate car would be above suspicion, and that would be an American Motors car. There's people that want economy, There's people who sincerely believe in the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, which to them really means, oh, come on, 65, 70 is okay. They tell me on the interstates now that you can cruise at 80 miles an hour if you want all day long and make time. And so there's always a controversy on speed and why do we have to make cars with so much horsepower. And the horsepower race now in Europe, when you read, they're talking of cars that are now capable of 150 miles an hour. Porsche has one that does 183 miles an hour. Ferrari last week announced a 189 mile an hour car to blow the doors off of a Ferrari Boxer and Lamborghini Countach. I don't know where you're going to get the tires. Can't they learn just by looking at some of these 500 mile an hour races? The tire changes that they make. Tires just simply aren't designed for that kind of punishment. And those kind of tires that they have that are sort of very flat, no tread, would be a nightmare once the pavement gets wet. It's getting the art of an automobile design is getting to be a little neurotic in some areas. We'd like to have economy, yet we do a lot of things to completely obliterate it. We're choking our engines to death in some cases. Maybe the electronics of the new carburation systems may be the ultimate solution. But it's a breathing engine, and to properly make it breathe, you just simply have to have double overhead camshafts, four valves per cylinder. Who knows, some idiot will probably come up and say, well, now that we're four valves per cylinder, what's wrong with six or eight small valves per cylinder? You wonder sometimes. Turbocharging is in, and it's made a break. But it's going to be very difficult. It's very difficult to forecast what's going to happen 10 years from now. It used to be easier for me to very accurately state what's coming. When they said, what do you think of the steam car? Well, it'll have to prove itself. Bill Lear is coming up with a new liquid called Lyrium. That sounds great. That's enough to say, oh, well, Lyrium cars will make the Stanley Steamer really go. But but I had no faith in the steam cars because one of his ultimate automobiles was really no better than a 1903 Stanley Steamer that ran on water. The advantage of a steam engine was that if a malfunction appeared, you could detect it immediately. There'd be steam coming out of someplace, so that meant we better find a blacksmith to plug up that hole. It's a masterpiece of simplicity, and it works great on heavy-duty things like locomotives. Even the farm tractors were steam burning in those days. And the problem is if you took a Stanley Steamer and you ran it real fast, our Indy cars are now using 1.6, 1.8 miles per gallon. And with a Stanley Steamer, it would just mean that, well, every 20 miles, stop and fill it up with 50 gallons of water. So there's something wrong there. Let's see.
Mr. Tremulous, in your career at Ford in advanced styling, you were able to come up with some rather unique aerodynamic prototypes, dream cars. Were you able to impose any of this progressive work that you did on production models of the 50s and 60s?
Yes, some of it I would say filtered on down. I remember that in 1960, on the T-Bird program, if you recall, the 58 and 59 T-Birds were the very straight-lined box type of philosophy. When 60 came along, I decided in the pre-production studio, after advanced styling had sort of disappeared and was budgeted out of existence, frankly, as a luxury item, and we also had fulfilled our mission of training 200 or 300 designers over a period of 4 or 5 years, that I the Thunderbird to me should have been a high-performance automobile. So I developed a 3/8 size model of what I thought a T-Bird should look like, and here I put the aerodynamic nose on the car. That was the first. Well-rounded windshields, front and rear, low belt lines, beautiful visibility, two blast tubes in the back, round tail lights that looked like all my rocket ships. While I had nothing to do with the instrument panel, I forget who it might have been. Could have been Dave Ash, who came up with a very exotic instrumentation for the T-Birds. It looked like the cockpit for the fighter pilot. Gearshift levers were with a button and wide open war emergency throttle control. Some people at the Ford Motor Car Company were very vitriolic about the car. They sort of nicknamed it the banana nose car. And my only defense was that the cars were the same weight, they had the same engines, but how come the banana nose was 6 miles an hour faster and more economical than the boxes? But those are the words of a stylist and aren't necessarily accepted by product planners who determine, who look at statistics of what the public really wants. Well, very frankly, the public really doesn't know what the hell it wants, but they'll never be satisfied until they get it. And we have to be, you have to have a subconscious feel for people. I used to practice by typing people. For instance, an American Motors car in a big Vons shopping area, and I'd see somebody pushing a basket. I'd say, I bet he's going over to a Nash. He's tall, he might have a Nash Ambassador, the biggie. You can tell the VW owners, the women, the men, the successful females today who are driving Porsches to work at high rates of speed on the freeway. This is California now, and they've got they're also drinking their cold drinks, diet-free stuff, and they're running 10, 15 miles an hour faster than you are, because I think they're doing it only to get to the washroom as quick as possible. So we have all sorts of types. Then there's the purists, of course. We have to take them in consideration. There's people who, enthusiasts who like old cars. I hate to admit it, but I have honorary memberships in some of the classic cars and all that, but somehow or other I feel that that's looking through a rearview mirror. I'm more interested in the future. And the older you get, you dream of hitting the next century. The year 2000 is going to be a real breakthrough. It's something I don't intend to even see, and I won't see it, but it doesn't stop me from thinking that I may as well put down on paper what I think the cars of 2000 are going to look like. It's going to be a very competitive thing. Now, the Fords, what came out of advanced styling were, what I always wanted to see was accidental breakthroughs. A good example was a car that I did called the Madame X Coupe. It was a T-Bird. And I stole from Gil Spear the spare tire that was located in the rear. For instance, if the belt line came like this and you got your rear wheel here, you carry the spare tire up higher and you hop up and you cover it with a beautiful streamlined shape. All right, carry one spare tire, and the other, which inspired the name Madame X, was that it's a hat box that carries a beautiful hat with a 25-inch rim, just like this. I remember the Edsel division coming in, and they were looking at the Madame X, and they said, boy, this is it, we love it. And I said, well, what do you mean? Are you going to throw out the vertical motif? No, no, they were looking at the front end. And they said, this front end that you've got here with the shape that you have and the fenders doing that is exactly what we need on the rear end of the Edsel. So it was a front end, a front end design minus a grill that they took verbatim and planted it on the rear of the car. And that was a breakthrough. They said, now we got a strong identification thing. Now all we have to do is take chrome and blend all the chrome into a shape that's compatible with the rear fender. All right, that was one thing. That was an accidental thing. Oh, we came up with safety ideas, turnover structures, seats that upon impact would fall back this way. Even some of our, the car called the Nucleon, which will be on display for the next 2 years through Smithsonian throughout the country. All right. The Nucleon was a car that Jim Powers, I assigned the task to him, but I gave him a preliminary sketch as to what I thought a nuclear car would look like and pointed out that the Nucleon, or what we referred to later as the Nucle, would be something like 26 inches in diameter. And we got to make that a very beautiful part. It's going to be a very heavy area on the car, which means that you can, I told Jim, you can come up with a canopy for the driver, the two-passenger thing, and two booms to hold this up and also to brace the two wheels in back. And put the driver's compartment ahead of the front axle. That'll balance the vehicle. And its justification was the Nucle has to be so gorgeous that it might inspire a new wheel disc if we get nothing else out of it. But what we got was a lot of publicity. Argonne Nuclear Energy of Chicago called us up when we showed pictures of the atomic car, and they wanted the specifications of it. And all this was just a forward dream. And then when we really carried it on, I asked, I figured people wouldn't understand what we're talking about when we're talking about the nerve center of the reactor, let's say, a fuel reactor. So we designed as if it were a fuel pump with a boom, and we had this disc that would open up, and coming down from this boom with flashing lights to a red transparent ball, we had the smallest light. It cost us $600 for this red ball. A tube went in there with other small tubes, and at the tip of the tubes was light, and this thing sparkled. So you're refueling the Nucle, as we call it, for the reactor. And that was a contribution. The Taj Mahal was another car that was to become a Mercury. It had low aerodynamics to it, much better than the existing car. And Mercury's always had to be 1 or 2 miles an hour faster, which meant bigger engines. And it sort of convinced the product planners that we don't have to tool for a larger engine anymore. Let's see what we can do with the stock Ford engine. God, there's so many cars. The X1000 that I was responsible for. Well, that was still a little bit too radical. There wasn't much they got out of that, except the top, which was a very beautiful thing. You would just slide it down like that, as if it were a baby buggy. Yeah, the canopy. It sort of forecasted some of the fender treatments that we'd like to see. Little bits and pieces, some of it from the interior, were picked up and refined. Sometimes it's difficult to know, like when I did the T-Birds, as to who really designed this T-Bird, because a lot of hands get into it. It goes into a production line, a production design studio. But ultimately, the only way you find out who in hell designed the thing was who got blamed for it. So I was blamed for that, and bits and pieces of the 64, broke away from the three-box syndrome. I can't say I was right. I remember at 3 o'clock in the morning in Chicago in the sleet storm. I want to show Chrissy before we check into a hotel.